This program are those of the host and the participants.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters Today. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you from Campbell Hall on the University of Illinois campus. We've got a live show coming to you today, so the phone lines will be open, and please do feel free to call in at 333-9455 or the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. Our guest today is one of my dearest friends and one of the top political journalists in the United States, or world today, national correspondent for The Nation magazine for many years, also the editorial page editor for the Capital Times newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, for many years, for which he won the Editorial Page Writer of the Year Award so many years in a row in Wisconsin, I think they named the award after him finally. He's the author of many books, a couple with yours truly, but his new book is Dick, The Man Who Would Be President, published by New Press, which will be coming out just in 2 or 3 weeks and promises to be one of the most talked about books of the political season. And it is my great pleasure to welcome to Media Matters today, John Nichols. John, are you here?
I am here. After that introduction, though, I'm not sure there's much I should say.
Oh, I think we'll find something for you to say. I'm not worried about that today, brother. Well, let's start. You just came back from Boston. You were at the Democratic Convention, and you have covered many political conventions, I know, in your career.
Yeah. I'm a political junkie, so I actually, you know, long before I covered them, I grew up watching them as a kid.
Yeah, you could do it in those days.
Yeah, they actually were, well, and they, on both sides, they were more interesting.
Yeah.
The conventions themselves are more interesting, and the media coverage is more intense.
Well, let's just, for an overview, what's your general assessment of what the Democratic Convention was like compared to other conventions? What do you think, how would you evaluate it? And then after that, a little bit about the press coverage.
Sure. Well, let's start with the basics. You know, the convention had all the spontaneity of a North Korean harvest festival. I mean, it was sort of surreal. They literally, each speaker came out, they would have all these like little minions who'd run out and hand out the posters that everybody was supposed to hold.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I'm not kidding about the North Korean thing. I mean, if you were in Eastern Europe during the darkest days of the Cold War or North Korea or Burma today, you know, when they have celebrations or big events, they flash different posters and stuff like that all in unison. And that was essentially what you saw. And so it was pretty pathetic in that regard. A lot of the delegates actually complained to me, and I talked to a good many of them, and even some prominent folks like Senator Russ Feingold chose not to speak because he said, you know, it's so scripted, I'm not going to be able to say anything interesting. So from that standpoint, I think the convention was an embarrassing affair because it didn't have, you know, it didn't have the life that the quadrennial gathering of one of the oldest political parties in the world ought to have, especially as they're about to compete for power in a critical election. By the same token, by the standards of contemporary politics, it was a success. It went off smoothly. Some of the speeches were spectacular, and I would include among them John Kerry's. And I'm not the biggest fan of John Kerry, but his speech was, I thought, very effective. It was hard on President Bush, which I think the Democrats need to be. By the same token, it had a decent introductory character. It told people a lot about him. And I thought it was delivered with a relative flair. Certainly wasn't the best speech of the convention, but it was pretty good. And the party did a good job of introducing some new leaders. Barack Obama from Illinois, who a lot of your listeners already know, but America got to know and I think was very impressed with. And Tammy Baldwin, the only open lesbian in Congress, who delivered a very good speech on health care, a number of other folks. So in a sense, from a pure party standpoint, you know, from a standpoint of, you know, do you present your face well, I think that they did the basics, and they certainly, I'm sure, as well as the Republicans will in about a month. But from a standpoint of actual drama, they were, pretty silly.
John, let me, before you go further, I know I asked you a question that could take you a whole hour. I want to follow up one point, which is, it seemed like, on one hand, you had the delegates to the convention who were ferociously anti-war for the most part, who were very critical of Bush and corporations, and really pretty, by and large, in the progressive branch of the political spectrum in the United States. And then you had the sort of a disconnect, because the rhetoric of the convention, especially Kerry's speech, is basically his pollsters and his advisors are looking at the American population, seeing that 40-some percent of suspected voters or likely voters are for Kerry, 40-some percent are for Bush, and they're pretty much locked in. And there's this very narrow sliver in a handful of states they're fighting for, and this is really who the message is aimed at, is, you know, these it's 5% of the voters in Ohio, Missouri, and Florida.
Right. I think it's a real fundamental mistake. And see, this is where we get into the complexity of conventions. And it also leads to your next question about media, because it's why the media ought to cover conventions more intensely, not less intensely, because there's real things that ought to be taken apart and discussed. But the complexity of political party conventions these days is that they have been turned into four-day infomercials. They are essentially a tool for the party that, you know, kind of gets this four-day concession to have all the journalists in the country come and a lot of their political activists to present an image. And I think the Democrats are making a bad strategic error, and it was reflected in the character of their convention, which was, you know, a little bit tepid. Most of the speeches were soft, not very inspiring. And it was also reflected in the fact that delegates were used mainly as, you know, kind of extras. They were sort of backdrops for the photo opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
You panned the crowd, everybody held a poster up. And that was sad, because I actually think, remember, these delegates are the people who were actually elected to come to this convention.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the people from the ground around the country. They're much more in touch with what's going on in America, certainly in their own states, than are the people on the podium, by and large. And, yes, the delegates, according to polling, were about 90% anti-war, about 70% in favor of gay marriage, about 75% against the Patriot Act. I mean, they were a very progressive bunch of folks. And you say, oh, my God, it would be so dangerous to let such progressive ideas be presented to America. I think quite the opposite. I think if you want to really build your base, if you want to reach out beyond the voting class and draw people in, this convention would have been far better suited to pick, you know, 10 random delegates and let them talk about what they think about the war and, you know, social and economic issues and you know, all the issues that are at stake. It would have been better drama. Would have been more interesting, because it wouldn't have been so scripted.
So the political calculus, John, then, is that the Kerry campaign sees that they will play for this, what they see as the center, these swing voters who are considering Bush, and they do focus groups on these people in the swing states to find the buzzwords and the issues that will resonate there. And the assumption is that the hardcore activists, the people who actually have to win the election, who are much more progressive, will be so appalled by George W. Bush that
right.
they don't need any pep talks from Kerry. They get it already, and they're just sort of, that's sort of the gamble that's being run with this strategy.
I think it's a terrible gamble. It is a gamble rooted in the sort of ugly and I think stupid way in which we play politics in this country today, which is to assume half the people can never be made interested and half the citizenry can never be brought into the process. I just don't think that's true. I also think that it's a miscalculation even in the context of the voting class. And Russ Feingold, the junior senator from Wisconsin, who was the only member of the Senate to vote against the Patriot Act, chose not to speak at this convention because he said, you know, look, it's so scripted, you're not going to really get to say much of interest.
And he's up for re-election.
He is up for re-election. But he would have spoken if they had, you know, if they'd come to him and said, look, Russ, we'd like you to talk for 10 minutes about why you oppose the Patriot Act or why you oppose the death penalty or why you oppose the war. He would have been delighted. In fact, he was at the convention. It certainly he was capable of doing it. And you should have seen it at the convention. Literally, people were walking up to him everywhere. There were kids, especially young people, coming up to him and, like, shaking his hand, saying he was their political hero. I mean, he couldn't walk into a room without a standing ovation.
Hmm.
But he wasn't on the podium.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, this, I think, is where the party makes its mistake. Putting someone like Russ Feingold up there to talk about the Patriot Act reaches out to a portion of the undecided voters that is probably as big as the centrist portion of the undecided voters, and that is those people who might vote for Ralph Nader, might vote for the Greens, might not vote. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And one of the things that Feingold points out, and he's right about this, is that some of the strongest opposition to the Patriot Act comes from conservatives.
Mm-hmm.
So if you put somebody up there who really talked about American freedoms and liberty and the Constitution, you might even find some Republicans breaking away from Bush.
Yeah, I mean, we had the sort of interesting position of Dick Armey opposing the Patriot Act.
Well, so does Bob Barr.
Bob Barr, I mean,
NRA,
some people on the far right, yeah.
Right. And so, you know, this is where, I mean, I think that it's a problem that the Democratic Party has. And as a result, they create a more tepid convention than the party itself is.
And they're drawing to an inside straight, it seems, that the, right. going after the center, the so-called centrist group.
And it's too safe a bet, you know, because George W. Bush is going to get up. And my bet is the Republican convention will make a much more aggressive effort to reach out. And, you know, whether they succeed or not, I don't know, because I think that a lot of people are incredibly skeptical about Bush and what he says. And, you know, his record for veracity is not real strong. But bottom line is that just at a core level, I think the convention was less than it could have been, because I think a more open, more freewheeling convention where controversial issues are put into play, where perhaps they even might have had a debate about the war, and I had many delegates say they would have loved to have had some sort of dialogue about the war. I think that would have energized the country more, would have made the convention more interesting, would have certainly drawn more media coverage, all these things. And I don't think it would have been, you know, a crisis, because the party is at core very united. So they could have had a more freewheeling, more engaged discussion and still not had the crises that you saw, say, in 1968, 1972, where the party was very divided and opening up issues led to, you know, real splits and some people leaving.
It was ironic that in the media coverage, which I want to talk about in a second, it was Pat Buchanan who commented that it's here we are in 2004 with a war that a majority of the people in the United States now consider a mistake. A very serious war, yet neither national party will be debating it at its platform or make it an issue in the race.
Just imagine if John Kerry had gotten up. And I thought Kerry's speech was better than I expected. I thought there was some real muscle in it. He was quite critical of the administration on a number of issues. But just imagine if John Kerry had gotten up and said, 33 years ago, I was introduced to the American people asking a question, you know, who will you ask to be the last man to die for a mistake? Tonight, I ask it once more.
Yeah.
You know? And what would the skin of, you know, how would that have harmed anyone?
Yeah.
Is there like one person who said, oh, my God, John Kerry is critical of this war. I'm not going to vote for him.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's ridiculous.
We're talking to John Nichols today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a live show, and if you'd like to call in, we have lines open. The number is 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. John Nichols, as many of our regular listeners know, is national correspondent for The Nation magazine and a Wisconsin newspaper editor, an editorial page editor of the Cap Times in Madison, Wisconsin, and an expert on politics in this country and much else. So please do call in if you want to talk to John. He has a brand new book coming out entitled Dick, the Man Who Is President. Is that correct title, John?
It's the Dick, the Man Who Is President.
About none other than our Vice President Dick Cheney. Will be coming out at the end of August, published by New Press, and it's going to be a major book by all accounts. It's going to be the book of the month.
It has been selected.
As a book of the month, and it's the first biography of our Vice President and the first sort of critical look at this man's history and record.
And it is we don't need to talk about it too much today because we really should talk.
No, we'll get you back on the air to talk about it before the election.
It is a dark tale, and it's one of the things, I will say, one of the things about Kerry's speech that I liked is that he didn't just criticize Bush. In the midst of his speech, he sort of went through a litany of complaint about members of the administration, a vice president who cuts backroom deals with the energy giants.
With polluters, he said.
With polluters. Then he did Rumsfeld, and then he also mentioned Ashcroft.
Yeah.
You know, an attorney general doesn't respect the Constitution. I thought that's very good, because one of the things that's important to remember is that in America, despite the fact that we are so personality-focused, again, a product of our media, we don't really elect individuals president. We elect administrations. And George W. Bush might actually be a reasonably nice guy. In fact, I've covered him. I've interviewed him. He's a pretty decent person if you talk to him one-on-one. But it doesn't really much matter, because he is surrounded by some of the darkest players in American politics, and they are exercising their power in ways that, as we know from the Paul O'Neill book and others, even Bush doesn't quite, has a hard time keeping up with, so to speak.
Hello, John Nichols. Let's go to our phone lines now. We have a couple of people who have been very patient. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Good afternoon, Bob. Good afternoon, John. Thank you for taking my call. I was hoping John might comment on a recent editorial of his I read about how the Democratic Party recently, very quietly, removed their platform supporting capital punishment in this year's convention. And I just think that's an interesting discussion that should be had in this country about that attitudes, I believe, are really changing about the death penalty, and that we need to really re-examine this issue in our society, considering that most of the world does not support the death penalty, does not even use the death penalty. Well, most of the, you know, what we'd call the industrialized world. So I was hoping you might comment on that. Thank you for taking my call.
Well, thanks for reading the column. Yeah, I did. I'm always interested in the policies of political parties and of candidates because, amazingly enough, you know, for all the talk we have about how you can't believe politicians, a lot of what they say during campaigns becomes the reality of their administrations. And one of the subtleties of John Kerry is that he's actually very opposed to the death penalty, has a long record of opposing it, going back to when he served as lieutenant governor of Massachusetts, and in Congress has co-sponsored Russ Feingold's bills to place a moratorium on the death penalty, to examine the racial components, to look at, you know, all sorts of other issues related to it. So he's actually been a good player on this issue. And so when they were writing the platform, which is essentially a reflection of the candidate, very quietly the platform drafters removed all references to Democratic Party support for capital punishment. Those references had been placed in the platform back in 1992 when Bill Clinton, a passionate supporter of the death penalty, was the Democratic nominee. And they were kept there in 96 and in 2000 because Al Gore was also a sympathizer with the death penalty. But now the party has returned to where it really was in the 1970s and 1980s, which is in opposition. And I think it's a wonderful place to go. I actually, you know, commend the party for it. And I think, again, this is one of those issues where, you know, the strategists will say, oh, it's very dangerous to talk about the death penalty.
Yeah, especially for those 3% of the voters in Ohio and northwestern Missouri that are going to determine the outcome.
Right. You know, but here's the deal. As Illinoisans know, the death penalty is a very complex issue, and you can actually have Republicans who have questions about it, like your former governor.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that what was done was a good thing, but it's sad to me that it was not discussed.
Yeah, it's conspicuous that this was not on the laundry list. It is an important philosophical difference now.
It's a huge difference.
Do you think the Republicans, on the other hand, are going to make a big deal out of this at their convention?
I doubt it. You know,
it's public opinion has shifted enough that it's not a power play anymore with those swing voters.
That's exactly right. You know, back in, especially with women voters, women are more skeptical of the death penalty than men. Among African American voters, there's overwhelming opposition to the death penalty. So it becomes a much more dangerous issue to exploit. Back in 1988, when George Bush's father exploited the issue in his race with Michael Dukakis, it's hard to think back that far, but people should remember, that was when cities were much more dangerous places. We had the crack epidemic and all the talk about that. And, you know, and so crime was a huge issue. It was much higher up the list of concerns in the country than it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And thus the death penalty was a more easily exploited issue. I don't think that John Kerry is going to be particularly harmed by taking this stance. And actually, I believe that there are some areas where it may help him, because I think there are a lot of liberals, a lot of progressives, a lot of folks in general who are very, very anti-death penalty and who have many of the concerns that your caller expressed. And but they're also, you know, kind of concerned about Kerry. They're not sure if he's really all that progressive a player. This is, you know, something he's got to present to them.
Well, we're talking to John Nichols today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. If you'd like to call in with a question for John, the number here is 333-9455, toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. John Nichols is a frequent guest on Media Matters and political commentator and a writer, what is your Washington correspondent? What is your title?
That's what they call me. It just means I write about politics.
He writes about politics for The Nation magazine as well as a daily newspaper in Madison, Wisconsin, the Capital Times, where he's been editorial page editor, and the author of many books, including the brand new book, Dick, the Man Who Is President, about Vice President Dick Cheney, which will be published by New Press within a couple of weeks. And we urge people to make their advance orders before that date to make sure they get a copy, because it's going to go fast.
See, we want it to be a bestseller, because then, you know, it'll force folks to talk about Dick Cheney.
Yeah, and I think you make a pretty compelling case in the book that he's someone people ought to know a heck of a lot more about than they presently do.
That's right.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines now. Line two, Champagne, thank you for your patience. You're on the air with John Nichols.
Yes, hello. I'm a member of a racial group that is the most loyal supporter of Democrats, so I've probably given myself away. and yet I am very much discombobulated, almost to the point of apoplectic, about the in the wake of the Democratic National Convention. Issues that I wanted to see discussed, unemployment at record levels in my community, disproportionate unfair incarceration systems in my community, John Kerry's statement about affirmative action, and his statement about putting the safety net back into welfare reform were never at best glossed over, and I don't even remember them being mentioned in this convention.
I don't think they were.
And I am very concerned because I heard some pundits, radio pundits, not with NPR, but on another station, raise anger or seem to be angered by Al Sharpton's departure from the script. And even though Al is not one of my great I don't admire him as an icon in the African-American community, I do attest to the fact that his departure from the script was a breath of fresh air as far as I'm concerned.
Caller, let me interrupt you. Didn't you think it was a great speech?
I thought it was a great speech,
just
a fiery
like
speech
him or not,
expecting Al Sharpton to deliver.
Yeah.
The fact I have, the point I have with the Democrats, if I could describe this convention in two words or less, it would be namby-pamby. And I don't believe that this vastly disappearing swing vote is going to be captivated, in my estimation, by a namby-pamby convention. This does not clearly define the Democratic values, separate and apart from the George W. Bush and his cohort values, such that we can get a clear choice. I'm forced to make this choice, anybody but Bush, and that in that sense, I'm voting for Kerry. Mm-hmm. But Kerry has not inspired me one bit, and I'm sorry to say that.
Well, you'd like him to do something to make it easier for you to go to your friends and neighbors and get them to come to the polls.
Absolutely.
Right.
And right now, I have there is nothing that would encourage me to even go to my next door neighbor, anybody in my block, to encourage them to vote. Kerry and his vice presidential candidate, other than to say Bush has been, in my estimation, an unmitigated disaster, and here in Republicanville. Where I live, that's hard to do because they still believe, notwithstanding George Bush's performance, that he, in some areas, walks on water.
Oh, there's folks who believe that.
So I don't understand why this election is so close in light of how George Bush and his colleagues have trampled the Constitution, in my estimation, and have blatantly engaged us in a war that's based on false pretenses where young men and women of the American Armed Forces and innocent Iraqis continue to die. So,
well, caller,
that's it.
Well, thank you very much, caller. John, this is
better than I could.
Yeah, in fact, we were talking about this before we went on air in case of Sharpton's talk. And then also, this is the point we've been talking about in the first part of the show, which is if you're appealing to this 3% in Ohio and Missouri who you're convinced are hardcore militarists, they love war, and
I don't think it's true.
No, but I mean, if you're working under this assumption, which explains the nature of the convention, I mean, the risk you're running is the people like that caller who won't vote for Bush, but they also now won't go out and do leafleting five weekends
caller,
in a row.
Let's face it, the guy who's just on the line is, you know, super engaged citizen. He obviously follows the news, listen to the convention, you know. And here's where the problem comes in. Let's accept that Ohio really is the core battleground state. It's the state that Kerry has to win. Went for Bush last time. If Kerry can switch it over, he might be elected president. Well, in the city of Cleveland, there are predominantly African-American precincts where turnout was as low as 15% in the last election. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you could do is present a message that really did energize the African-American community and, you know, dealt with some of the issues that the caller just raised, affirmative action, you know, really putting a safety net back into welfare, capital punishment, all sorts of other related issues. And if you could, let's say, triple that turnout in those Cleveland precincts, those votes are just as real, just as important, and just as likely to swing Ohio as if you go out, you know, searching the suburbs for some wavering, undecided voter. And so this is the problem, I think, that the Democratic Party has. It's, it's a little scared about talking to its base in a way the Republicans aren't afraid of. They'll go talk to their base.
And John, let me interject one other question here. I mean, how much a factor do you think it is that Kerry and the Democratic planners are running to the pundits? They know that if they do what you just said makes sense, that they'll probably get slaughtered by the conventional wisdom as McGovernites and wackos who hate America.
But you see, that's the point. Politics is a constantly evolving game. You know, Democrats keep fearing their old losses rather than, you know, learning from them. In 1964, the Republicans ran Barry Goldwater for president. He got whooped. And so what did the Republicans do? They say, okay, well, we're never going to run another conservative, ever? No. They went out and figured out, okay, how do we present this more effectively? You know, we still want to run on the same issues. We just want to do it better. And they eventually found Reagan, ran, and won. There's no reason that Democrats couldn't do much the same thing. And I think, actually, the political dynamic in the country has moved toward a place where a real progressive populist message could do very well. And it kind of gets back, again, the pundits are the most useless humans in the game because, you know, they were the ones who were terrified by Al Sharpton's speech. They're like, oh, my God, Al Sharpton went off script.
Yeah, apparently Chris Matthews almost had to be hospitalized.
Well, it's Judy Woodruff from CNN. Literally, I was there. You know, I've seen her. She was literally going, oh, my God, he's hijacked the convention. Well, I mean, with all due respect.
There was a code orange in the newsroom?
Right. Oh, they were just shaking. And, you know, even the Kerry people weren't that concerned because if you actually listened to what Sharpton said, it wasn't like he, you know, went and said some crazy thing. He just said black people are probably not going to vote for Bush because he hasn't been a very good president. And also that African Americans treat the right to vote seriously because they had to win it with the blood of civil rights martyrs. The little girls in Birmingham, you know, Goodman, Cheney, Schwerner. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I saw the speech. I had to see it online, but I did see it.
But that wasn't exactly a dangerous speech.
No, in fact, he called for the support of Kerry Edwards repeatedly and emphatically.
And so my argument on this is that, you know, the media has become so obsessed with keeping our politics within a very narrow zone. Between sort of center-right and center-left, but more towards center-right, that they become the policemen.
Yeah, let me rephrase this to get a point I really want to get at. You're getting at it, too, but I want to be really clear here. How much of a factor in the thinking behind Kerry's strategy, for both your speech and the broader strategies he approaches the campaign, is the thinking that, you know, if I come out with a very progressive platform that will draw new voters in, that really have appeal, they'll send the delegates in this convention home like absolutely energized like they've never been in their lives to get involved, that the immediate spin that's going to hit every network, every cable channel for the next 24 hours and that the Republicans will blow on is that this guy's off the deep end, ultra-leftist, kook ball who completely has, you know what I mean? Just like this is like the biggest joke since Harold Stassen.
Right. But see, here's the
thing. And that they're scared of that because they know that spin after the talk is exactly what's going to, evidence shows, can have a lot of influence how people think the candidate is.
They're terrified of it. But you see, again, this gets back to that core question of, you know, do you learn from your past mistakes and your losses, or do you just kind of get scared by them and keep becoming more and more cautious? Conservatives had failures politically. They didn't stop being conservatives. They went out and figured out more effective ways to communicate their messages. And, you know, progressives at least within the Democratic Party, have not done a very good job of that. So as a result, you know, the pundits are going to scream and yell and say stupid stuff. The answer is that a presidential candidate is the one person in politics who has a genuine ability to leap over the pundits and to, you know, you can almost always command the cameras. You can almost always get, you know, on the morning talk shows if you want. You've got a lot of entree.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I mean, Kerry could go out there and you know, put a, for lack of a better term, a spin on almost anything that's done at the convention. And if he does it well, if he's capable, it works. And I think that the fear factor is absurd. The one thing that you need to remember is that pundits and national media folks who cover conventions, especially the TV folks, they don't know much about politics. They're not very good at politics anymore. It's not like the old days where you had, you know, people really did kind of, you know, come out of the urban areas and knew the political structures. These people are really much more into the personalities and the cheap shots. And yes, they tend to police things toward a caution and conservatism. But I actually think, you know, work the right way, they can be taught something. They might actually learn a little bit about politics. And frankly, the sacrifice to fit into their narrow parameters of what is interesting or what is right on the part of the Democratic Party is so great that it's too much.
We're talking to John Nichols today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a couple phone lines open at 333-9455 or at the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We've got a lot to talk about with John. We have a caller that's been very patiently waiting. Before we get to that caller, John, I do want to ask you one more question. There is a considerable debate on among progressives who are either at the left flank of the Democratic Party or who are outside the Democratic Party about whether to support for Kerry, or to vote for a Green, or to mm-hmm. vote for Nader Kameho, which are running as an independent. And what's your take on this?
I don't tell people how to vote. I think people on the president in presidential politics, people are smart enough to figure out, you know, where their values are and where they draw the line. I think that practically what we can say is this. Polling tells us that right now in most of the battleground states, if you add Nader to the mix, and Nader's the only of the left candidates, socialist, green, others, who seems to, you know, kind of register at a relatively high level in the polling, he's drawing almost evenly from Bush and Kerry. That's one of the most fascinating developments in the last month or so of this campaign is that Nader has actually started to eat into some of the Republican base. And so I frankly don't think that he's a particular threat. I think that, you know, when all is said and done, most people will choose between Bush and Kerry, and that's what they ought to do. If that's where they think the action is, they should go there. By the same token, if they can't stomach either of them, you know, cast your vote. The only thing I tell people to do is go vote.
Yeah.
And I think people are rational enough to sort it out. For myself, I think Bush is a terrible danger to the country. I really do believe that he is surrounded by folks who are deeply troubling, and that Bush himself is a very weak figure and a very ineffectual president. I have been impressed a little bit by things like Kerry's opposition to the death penalty and some of his movement on a few issues such as trade, but he's certainly not as progressive as I'd like him to be. And, you know, beyond that, though, I mean, I think most people can sort these things out.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines on that note. Line 4, Fort Worth, Texas, thank you for your patience. You're on with John Nichols.
Thank you, Bob.
All the way from Fort Worth.
I love your show. Contrary to the local NPR fundraising statement, your show actually is radio worth listening to. John, this may be a subject matter more for a book than a thumbnail sketch on this program, but I would like to hear your analysis of Dwight David Eisenhower's warning against the military-industrial establishment, its encroachment upon our politics and society since his warning, and how it has an effect upon the duopolistic plutocracy that exists in Washington, D.C. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I should add, before we give John a chance to answer that question, that you also have another new book out, John, an edited anthology that you edited.
Yeah, that's going to come out later in the year.
Coming out later this year, that deals with the question of the United States as an empire.
Yeah.
And so this is an issue you've actually given considerable thought
to. I've spent a lot of time on it, and it's a great call. And it actually, not to say that, and I certainly won't try to give it short shrift, but it actually can be reduced to a thumbnail. I mean, that's the painful reality. Dwight David Eisenhower said that Americans should be very careful of a military-industrial complex. The reason that he warned about it was that he feared that you would create a situation where there were commercial interests who were advantaged by the U.S. going to war. And I would suggest that Eisenhower's prediction and his expression of concern has been fully realized in the current war. We have, as our vice president today, in Dick Cheney, a former Secretary of Defense, who, when he served as Secretary of Defense, took the lead in privatizing the military, i.e. moving immense amounts of what the military had traditionally done out to contract with private companies. And then he became the head of one of those companies, Halliburton, which its Brown & Root subsidiary is one of the primary beneficiaries of military contracts. And now he's back as vice president orchestrating a war. I don't see that we need to go much further than looking at Dick Cheney and really the Bush administration in general to see that Eisenhower was right to warn us, and also to express a genuine concern, because the Democrats should be screaming a lot louder about this. I am glad that there was some reference in some of the speeches, including Kerry's, to some of the worst of the contracting abuses involving Halliburton. But, I mean, this is a real issue, and it is a fundamental issue. And we ought to be talking about the fact that at this point there are interests that pressure this country to enter into wars because they make more money if we are at war. And I think we're in that circumstance, and we ought to get out of it. We ought to move back toward a military that does all the work that it's supposed to do, i.e., you know, if we go to war, you know, there ought to be people cooking the food and digging the trenches and doing all that. Soldiers should be doing that, not private contractors, because it's an incredible thing. You realize that in Iraq today, if a ditch is dug by a soldier, he gets paid, you know, not much better than minimum wage. If a ditch is dug by a Halliburton employee, he's getting $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year to do it. That is an absurd construct. It's costing the American taxpayers a lot more, but it's also creating a lobbying interest.
Well, we're creating jobs in the private sector. I guess that's the bright side.
Yeah, but then you create it for those poor, you know, I mean, remember the guy, the Halliburton employee?
I'm being facetious, John.
No, but remember the poor Halliburton employee that got kidnapped over in Iraq?
Yeah.
He was a farmer who was losing his farm, and he went to Iraq because he needed the money to save his farm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that didn't create jobs in the private sector. That's creating a kind of an escape valve to avoid dealing with fundamental issues at home.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. Line one, Champagne, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Hi. Yes, John, I totally agree with your critique of the rather tepid nature of the Democratic Convention and of Kerry's campaign in general. And I was wondering if you could just sort of look ahead over the next 4 to maybe even 20 years and sort of project what will happen to the Democratic Party if Kerry loses this fall. Because I think that Kerry could legitimately lose this election, not just have it stolen, but actually lose it. And, I mean, my sense is that if that happens, 4 years from now, there will be a war within the Democratic Party between the progressive majority and sort of the centrist DLC elements. And if the progressive majority loses control of the party in 2008, I can see that progressive majority becoming so disenchanted that they leave the party and start a new party, sort of a la the Republican Party in 1854. And 6 years later, you know, Lincoln was elected. So I was just wondering, if you could look ahead, what will happen if Kerry loses this election?
Well,
John, before you answer that, let me just interject one thing. Because I mentioned Alex Coburn and his case against voting for Kerry.
Yeah.
And one of his arguments is that a Kerry defeat means that the Democratic Party will go through this sort of turmoil. And in the long run, that will be good for progressives, that Democrats out of power is good for the prospects for progressive organizing. That, I should add, just to qualify it, as a minority opinion. I think Naomi Klein, Doug Henwood, most people who are progressives or on the left think they do better when there's a Democrat in the White House.
Well, and even whether they do better or not, I mean, I think you also have to step back and look at the current crisis. You know, you have to ask yourself, do we invite a fight, you know, this great struggle that will take perhaps, you know, if the caller's timeline is right, you know, at least 6-7 years. Maybe longer, and do we ask kind of both the people of Iraq, the soldiers who are on the ground in Iraq, the Americans in many parts of this country who are suffering as a result of a horrible economy and all sorts of problems like that, to, you know, kind of wait for things to get sorted out, or we try to, you know, put a bandage on? That's the oldest debate in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you, though, the caller's question is exactly on target, fundamentally on target. And I would say this is true for both political parties. The United States is an intensely divided country right now. And both political parties are trying, at least somewhat in this campaign, to play to the center. And in each case, they have sort of angry bases that aren't quite sure they're doing the right thing. I know it's hard to imagine, but there are many conservatives who are deeply troubled by the Bush administration. They think it's gone way over the deep end on spending, that many of them are uncomfortable with the war in Iraq.
And many of them opposed all the Clinton wars.
Right. And so what you've got is within both parties there's a lot of internal tension. And I believe whichever party loses this election is going to face a real kind of shakeout. And it will probably go in the direction that the caller is bringing up, where I think there that both within the Democratic Party if it loses or within the Republican Party if it loses, you're going to have a lot of struggle, a lot of sturm und drang, and it might lead to the creation of a new political party, perhaps drawing from, you know, out of, it actually could be a party of the center, to be honest, with then the Democrats becoming more a party of the left, the Republicans more a party of the right. I mean, and that would be, that party of the center might be the John McCain party, for lack of a better term. But I think it's very realistic to assume that if the Democrats lose this election, there will be open warfare, both within the Democratic Party and within the labor movement, over what direction to take. And it could be, it could take a real long time and be a really rough fight. Remember, the British Labor Party lost power in 1979 and essentially went through a struggle over the next 18 years to get back to power. And that included divisions, creation of new parties, splits, recreations, you know, all these struggles. I'm not saying that the American Democratic Party is necessarily going to go that way, but I do think that there'll be something rough, because already you have, just to circle around and finish this thing up, you know, remember, Howard Dean ran for the Democratic nomination this year, saying Democrats had to run as Democrats. They had to stand up strong. He hasn't really, you know, he didn't prevail. Obviously, he's not the nominee, and the Democrats aren't really doing that, at least at this point. So you're going to have a sector of folks, if Kerry loses, who are going to point to Dean and say, you know, that guy was right. And I think that he and his group, Democracy for America, which is the sort of outgrowth of his campaign, could become a central sort of organizing block for a new Democratic Party, or some sort of battle within the Democratic Party with the more conservative forces.
John Nichols, we have a full bank of phone calls, and I want to make sure each of our callers has an opportunity to ask you a question. Line 3, Jim from Urbana, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Hi, John.
Hi, Jim.
And hello to all my friends in Madison. You might distinguish for us the 1933 election of von Hindenburg versus Hitler. And give me your take on that. I'll hang up and let you go.
Well, the caller actually raises a very appropriate question.
Yeah, a lot of people make but I've heard on a few occasions people make the comparison between this election and the German election of 1933.
Right. And I think that's a bit of a stretch, because I think we always have to be careful with throwing around Hitler and Nazi as terms, although both now critics of Bush and supporters of Bush have tended to use it in this campaign. But
supporters of Bush?
Also, yeah, they've
that's an interesting comparison.
No, they attack Kerry.
Oh, I was going to say.
So each side has accused the other of being a Nazi. Look, the bottom line was, in 1933 in Germany, there were splits on the left, and Hitler and the Nazis did not receive a majority of the vote. In fact, they were, you know, actually a rather weak minority. But because the left was not able to form into effectively what you'd call a popular front, you know, get everybody together and beat the bad guy, the bad guy came to power. And it wasn't really that he was running against von Hindenburg. It was just that von Hindenburg was sort of the in charge of things ultimately, and so Hitler was able to pressure him on the basis of a relatively strong election showing to have power in Germany ceded to him, to Hitler. And I think that's why people bring the reference up. There's this question of, you know, should everybody on the left kind of get together to get rid of Bush? And if they don't, are they running the risk of creating some dramatically darker future where, and you know, the darkest scenario you'd imagine is, you know, John Ashcroft really does get Patriot Act II, and the United States becomes a far more oppressive, less free country, and the Bush administration continues its sort of military adventurism abroad, finding new countries to invade, maybe Syria or someplace like that. And just in so many ways, the U.S. becomes a less free, less functional country. And if that is the future that's threatened, then the question is, you know, why wouldn't anybody kind of get on board to stop that? And it's a legitimate question. I mean, I think I'm always cautious about people who try the analogies back to that period, because there were different times and different people. But I do think that's the great question for people on the left. Is the threat of George W. Bush serving another term so great that you have to put aside discomfort with sort of a more tepid Democratic Party and do what you can to stop stop this president from continuing to serve. What's interesting is that a lot of lefties, people like Noam Chomsky, have said that we are at that point.
And yeah, so is Ed Herman, who I don't think has supported a Democratic candidate in his life.
Well, that's what I mean. So I think we're essentially seeing a lot of that already,
yeah,
where there is sort of a coalescence on the left.
We're talking to John Nichols, national political writer for The Nation magazine, author of the hot new book, Dick, The Man Who Is President, today on Media Matters. It's a live show. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We've got a couple callers I want to get to in the remaining 7 minutes on the air. Line two, Urbana, you're on the air with John Nichols.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Yes. I'll be very brief. If George Bush is reelected, does anything make any difference? If he appoints two or three ultra-conservatives, 40-year-olds, to the Supreme Court,
mm-hmm,
if he continues to allow a concentration of the media,
mm-hmm,
and no restraints, if he does, as you said, possibly persist in military adventures, is there going to be any? And, of course, if Dick Armey continues to do his redistricting and this becomes a fashion across the country, will there ever be another free election?
Well, you see, this is a concern that a lot of folks have. And,
you know, and maybe, John, he touches on a new point, so we don't have to keep hammering the same points.
Sure.
I mean, what I think a lot of people are only vaguely aware of is how few races in the United States for Congress, in the House of Representatives specifically, are competitive, and due to gerrymandering, and even those that are competitive, like all the Senate seats that can't be gerrymandered because they're statewide, the role of money is so intense that they really aren't especially competitive necessarily.
And you add to that a media that doesn't cover politics.
Yeah, you put all those things together. Yeah. I mean, the idea that, you know, we've got some serious problems in River City even before you talk about George W. Bush.
Yeah, we have a democracy that is very sick and maybe dying. And, yeah, I mean, and John Kerry alone ain't going to fix that. And it's a much deeper crisis. So, but I think the caller's point is appropriate. And I think he gets to that fundamental question, you know. I mean, how endangered is American democracy? Well, half of Americans don't vote. And
that's in a good year. I mean, it's two-thirds in the off-year election, yeah.
And we have an exceptionally dysfunctional democracy. You know, half the people in the Senate are millionaires because you buy your way in now. You don't get elected in the old-fashioned way of actually campaigning on ideas. And so things are really bad. I think it's fair to say 4 more years of George W. Bush would make things dramatically worse because George Bush, unlike many Republicans, and there are many Republicans who are much better than him, you know, unlike many Republicans, George W. Bush's respect for democracy seems to be extremely limited. He has that quote, and I just leave it at this, where he said, you know, that he sort of likes dictatorships as long as he's a dictator. I mean, I don't think he was joking. I mean, I'm not saying he has dreams of being a dictator, but what I would say is this is a guy who has shown no respect for the complexities of democracy and for the realities of it. And neither have people like Tom DeLay and John Ashcroft and others who are in key positions. And with the Voting Rights Act coming up for renewal and all sorts of other issues in play, I think that giving these guys another 4 years is a pretty scary notion for just healthy, thriving democracy. And I believe, honestly, that that's why a number of conservatives, including people like Pat Buchanan, have been so critical of this administration. I think you may see in the next month that Buchanan comes out against Bush's reelection.
I wouldn't be surprised based on what I heard in his expert punditry. John, yeah, you know, there were a handful of demonstrators that we heard about in Boston, and they didn't get much attention, except for Medea Benjamin being dragged from the convention floor with an anti-war sign. The Republican convention's coming up in a few weeks. You're going to be there, I know.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be a few more demonstrators there, aren't there?
Oh, it'll be much different. I think the running joke in Boston was there weren't many demonstrators because they were saving their money for New York. And I think there's truth in that. That the really, you know, there's a consciousness that the force that people are angry with right now is George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and the Republican Party. And
I mean, could this be like a Chicago 68 thing? Do you think?
I think that it's unlikely because the fear of terrorism has created a much much more intense policing.
Yeah, so they're like they're on a compound
away,
like in Greenwich, Connecticut, where
they
demonstrate.
Yeah, someplace down in Georgia, I think. But
yeah.
They're pushed away. But I do think that you're going to see substantial demonstrations, and I think you're going to see a lot more energy. And one thing to remember politically about this is that the more intense demonstrations in New York are, probably the more damage it does to Bush. Because what we know from Chicago in 68 was Chicago 68 didn't harm Richard Nixon, it harmed Hubert Humphrey.
Mm-hmm.
And when trouble follows a candidate, that people begin to associate that with him. They begin to say, you know, look, you know, this guy really does seem to stir up trouble.
Well, let's go back to the phone lines. We have one last caller who's been very patient from the great sunflower state of Kansas. You're on the air with John Nichols.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hey, and finally a woman, too, which is very good.
Yeah, John, you usually attract a lot more women.
No, I'm just saying, I'm delighted to hear your voice.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you fine. Please go ahead.
Hey, good. I can't hear you too well, so I'll just have to ramble and then shut up. As far as demonstrations in New York, I had an idea, and I just thought I'd float it here. What if everywhere they went, the Republicans at that convention saw peace signs?
Mm-hmm.
You know, on all the people, on all the streets, you know, the sidewalks. They couldn't go out to dinner. They couldn't do anything without seeing peace signs.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what that would do to maybe diffuse them a little.
Well, you know what, dear? I think that's a really good idea, because one of the biggest concerns I have about the demonstrations in New York is that they will send hundreds of different messages, and it won't be the consistency of message that can really drive something home. I'm a big fan of the group Code Pink, which is a group formed by Medea Benjamin and others that just asked women to wear pink to protest the war. And maybe women and men and everybody in New York ought to wear pink with a peace sign on it. Because I do think that that's one of the dangers is when you have many, many protests and many, many interests kind of raising all sorts of concerns, it's easy for the media to dismiss it as a cacophony, to just say, oh, there's all these people griping about all these different things. It's much better when you can unite all the voices of protest into sort of one loud chorus. And one of the ways to do that is with symbols, peace symbols, the Code Pink, you know, pink outfits, things like that, whatever the vehicle. I know that the group United for Peace and Justice and some of the different groups are working to try and coordinate the protests. And I hope they succeed, because in a democracy, street protests are as much part of democracy as a national convention or an election. The Constitution protects them all, and we ought to celebrate all of these aspects of it, because they're all signs that a democracy is functioning.
In fact,
ought to cover the protests as much as they cover.
Yeah, in fact, as your point was, many people forget that in the First Amendment, the right to assemble and the right to address the government are two of the five core privileges of a free society.
And there's also freedom of the press in there.
And that's right, and freedom of speech and freedom of belief.
And the reason the press is given freedom is to cover things like this.
Well, so John, do you hear the band tuning up in the background?
I do, I'm afraid.
That means they're trying to push me out of the studio for the next show. I want to thank John Nichols for being our guest today in Media Matters. John's the author of the brand new book, Dick, the Man Who is President, coming out in a couple weeks with New Press. Everyone's assigned to read it if you're listening to this show. I'll be back a week from today with Robert Greenwald, the producer and director of the movie Outfoxed. And I want to thank Andrew Boyle for being the producer, and I'll see you all in 167 hours. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Sugar Creek Symphony and Song, an opera and classical music festival in Watseka, Illinois from August 6th through 8th, featuring violinist Nicholas DiEugenio with folk songs for the violin. More info at sugarcreekfestival.org.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, partly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, the high in the upper 80s with south winds around 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy with a low in the upper 60s and southeast winds around 5 miles per hour. Tomorrow, partly sunny and hot, the high around 90 degrees with south winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at will.uiuc.edu. It's 2 p.m. Central Time. A Prairie Home Companion is next.